that's why I'm saying they should ask.
As a place right for the two phones, that has a great aesthetic in the market for two phones.
This does everything.
That's a magnificent infrastructure. You can turn that.
No, there's only one as you're out there.
Hey. Subjective logic, yeah. Do you know what? No?
No?
Well, maybe I do under another name.
Something like holistic logic, only with the concept of uncertainty.
Yeah. So it's a form of modal logic, then, is it?
Sorry?
It's a form of modal logic. There's this kind of thing. Yeah.
It's basically like.
Yes. Okay, imagine
this. I was wondering,
yeah, these things are popular because it's not just that. It's also in agent-based systems where you have to reason other agents. You may not believe what the other agent is saying, for instance. So yeah, it's very popular because there's a whole thing, a whole kind of aspect of research called BDI. It's like believe, deliberate, and then decide what to do. So it's like there's a kind of engine or a kind of mode or a kind of approach known as BDI, which is based on these kind of logics.
Where you have no choice of belief. Is there some other name for
this?
Because
I've not heard. So the thing I would look at are non-monotonic logics and belief logics, for instance.
Okay.
So that might probably give you more information, because then you can have this: I believe what I believe, and I believe what other people say. So it becomes a modality. So it's all to do with notion of moral logics, and then you end up with what's known as cryptic structures and all these kind of things. And then you can have these paths depending on what you believe about other people's beliefs, because you don't necessarily believe what you believe either. You can come up with all sorts of funny things then when it comes to belief.
And that's the subjective logic.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
The main thing I run out of most of them, there was triangle between both two and
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because then you can start talking about things that you know, All right. Hey, so I checked the rating of your game. It's only 3 out of 5 stars.
Just came out. It's like 40 quid. Okay? Is it good? Use it. All right. All right, shall we carry on from last time? So I'm just going to refresh your memory about generalized modus ponens, because we're going to actually use this.
The light, okay. So remember, so generalized modus ponens, the idea of this inference rule there, where you have a particular implication with a number of hypotheses, so P1 to Pn, right? And with some a unique, just one conclusion there, right? And what you're trying to do is to match the hypotheses. So one way of looking at this is going forward, we're trying to discharge all these various assumptions or all these various hypotheses and matching them with facts in the knowledge base. And then by doing this, when you do the matching, you get a substitution that you apply to the conclusion there, and this becomes the new fact, for instance, that you can add to your knowledge base. We'll see there are two ways of using this rule. One is this forward inference or forward chaining, and the other one is the backward chaining. We're going to look at this today. So hopefully this is clear enough, right? Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so it's just a general form of modus ponens. We've seen that, you know, we can do the Schirrite sound by just reducing it to modus ponens through this notion of universal instantiation and application of substitutions. So I'm not going to go through this again. What I'm going to do is to look at this example because we're going to use it. So one thing that you may be given is a particular situation like this. The law says that it is a crime for an American to sell weapons to hostile nations, right? The country no, an enemy of America, has some missiles, and all of its missiles were sold to it by Colonel West, who is American, right? The question is, if you're given this problem, is to show, is to prove that Colonel West is a criminal, right? Based on what you've been given here. So how would you do this? Well, what we're going to do is you can just transform this into, well, that's the first step, is to transform this into some kind of language that can actually be used for deduction, for reasoning. So first the logic, for instance, right? So our knowledge base is going to try and capture these ideas of some general rules in there and also some actual specific things, right? So it is a crime for an American to sell weapons to hostile nations, for instance. Could be captured by, for instance, American X and weapon Y. If X sells Y to Z and Z is hostile, then X is a criminal, right? That's just one way of capturing this. But there may be more than one way of doing this, right? But this is one we could pick. If X is American, so implicitly there we have universal quantifiers. I'm not showing them, right? So for all X, for all Y, for all Z, because I want to be able to use these rules directly as part of my generalized modus ponens. So I'm going for this. All variables are assumed to be universally quantified, so it's implicit, okay? So that's why I'm writing it like that. And one would be, no, has some missiles, so that would be it. There exists an X, no owns X, and X is a missile. So what you would do is we need to try and get rid of the existential quantifier. And we've seen this before. One way of doing this is just to replace it by some arbitrary, some fresh new constant. It's this colonization step, right? It means we just say, okay, no owns some missile M1. Right, some M1, which is a missile. We don't know what it is. We're just going to assume it's a fresh constant, right? And all of its missile was sold to it by Colonel West. So if X is a missile, Nunu owns X, means that it implies that West sold X to Nunu. These are easy. Missiles are weapons. An enemy of America counts as hostile, right? So these are all general rules, and these are specific facts about the problem. West is an American. And Nunu is an enemy of America. Actually, this one is also a bit specific. It's not. It is about the particular problem because it's talking about one particular country, right? So I could have separated this and made this a bit nicer. So these are general facts, right? And that's also a general fact. These are specific to the problem. So I don't know if any of you know anything about ontologies. Do you know anything about T-box and A-box? Have you ever heard of these things? So when you're looking at ontology reasoning, and that's quite common these days, especially, you know, it's all been developed as part of like notion of semantic web and reasoning over the web, right, in terms of having more, not just syntax, but also semantics. And it separates things into what's known as a T-box, which is just a general kind of information about the problem. In this case, you would have this. It's just a general thing. It's not saying anything about any particular situation, right? So that would be one. So this one would be another one. They're just general facts. These would be what's known as the T-box. The other one are more specific to the problem at hand, so they would be what's known as the A box. Don't worry, we just to link these things, right? So, but this would be our knowledge base in this case. We don't care about separating things in that way. So, that's one possibility. You all generally happy with this? Should be, because otherwise we can't carry on. So, what we saw last time was the rules for the quantifiers and reducing first order logic to proportional logic, right? So remember, this is a good thing to do, especially when you don't have any. When is it good? Especially good. reducing this to, why would we want to reduce first-order logic to, when would we especially want to do that? When? Hmm? Yeah, of course, but what particular situation is, what type of sentences of first-order logic are especially good for this reduction? When they don't have any? No, it's not that. No. No function symbols. Remember, because if you have no function symbols, you can ground everything in one go. Otherwise, you have to do this recursive thing. And there's a theorem by Herbron from the 1930s that tells you, you know, if you've been able to ground it immediately, there's no function symbol, you're not going to end up with an infinite set of ground sentences, right? And now immediately you can use your DPLL or you can use your walk SAT or whatever. So remember this. So it's very nice, but what happens is that it doesn't work that nicely once you have function symbols because you can keep infinitely deep terms, right? So you can do father of A, father of A, father of, and you keep going. And that doesn't mean that it, you know, it doesn't mean that if you're able to use an algorithm of some kind that you're going to be able to show that it follows necessarily because it could be arbitrarily deep, could go on forever. And we also looked at the unification as equation solving. And I introduced generalized modus ponens, and we're going to use it a bit more now, just for this backward chaining and this forward chaining thing. Where is my other lecture? Oh, here we go. So actually, this title is slightly misleading. It's not just about resolution-based. So it should really be like forward chaining, backward chaining, and resolution-based inference, because forward chaining and backward chaining are not viewed as resolution-based, right? So it's from 9.3 to 9.6 of Russell and Norvig. Okay, let's see. So these are three things we're going to look at. These are three kind of algorithms in terms of trying to show whether something is NT or something follows from a knowledge base, right? And this one is different in the sense that it's a refutation-based algorithm. It's going to take the negation of something, add it to the clause that you have, usually the negation of the goal, and try to derive the empty clause, basically false, right? You've done resolution before, you said. Is that right? So it should be a revision for you guys. Okay? Let's start straight into it for forward chaining. I don't know. Maybe no. Let's do the example first. I think it's probably easier. I don't know why I have this in that order. These are the sentences that we had from the previous lecture, basically just 2 minutes ago, right? So we had this. And what we want to show is to see, okay, can we derive that West is a criminal, right? And let's look how this might work if you're doing what's known as a forward chaining way of doing this. So forward chaining, the way it works is that it says, okay, what are my facts, right? And then from my facts, can I apply my modus ponens rule in a forward fashion and hope that eventually I will derive something that matches the goal I'm trying to prove? That's the idea. You go forward. That's why it's called forward chaining. Let's look at an example here, right? And then we'll look at the algorithm. So what are the facts that I have in my problem here? They're all in red. I know that Nono owns some missile M1, right? I know it owns M1, and that M1 is a missile, so I can have these two there. I also know that Wes is an American, there. So these two there. And I know that Nono is an enemy of America, right? So these are my facts. What I'm going to try and do is I'm going to use these rules there. So these are my production rules in a way, right? My rules, I'm going to just try and match the assumptions to the facts that I have, because if I'm able to do this, hopefully I can discharge all these assumptions and I can add this as a new fact, right? With me? So how do we do this? Well, we can look at it like this. So we have these two, for instance, right? Oh, what can we do? So we know something's a missile. Well, we also know that going forward it's a weapon, right? Okay? And we also know that if we have a missile and Nono owns M1 is a missile and Nono owns this, right? So we can say that we can use this one to say that West sold M1 to Nono, right? So it's going forward, right? It's matching this and this against these two, and we have this as a new fact. So we have suddenly two new facts there. Well, we also have this one. If somebody is an enemy, some country is an enemy of America, it means that it's a hostile nation, right? So suddenly now we have these as facts, but we have derived new facts, right? We've discovered new things. So forward chaining is often a kind of discovery algorithm, right? So it's quite interesting the way it works. If you have a big database, you can actually use it to try and discover new facts about your problem. And now we have this, that M1 is a weapon. I mean, in this case, it's pretty simple, right? But our hope is that we keep going forward, we can eventually prove that West is a criminal, right? We can derive this. So what else can we do? Well, actually, it's quite easy in this case. If we have this, we have West is American, and weapon M1 sells West M1 to Nunu and hostile Nunu, we can actually match against this one by making X West and making Y M1, right? And all these work. And suddenly we have this, because that's the conclusion, right? So we've got the fact that we wanted to prove this goal, and suddenly we can prove it by going forward like this, right? So that's the idea of forward chaining. Of course, this is a very simple example, which is really nicely constrained, right? Imagine now if you had like 15 different rules where it says something like this, American weapon Y, sell it, and then it's like fun person or great friend or whatever, right? Some other thing, and you have like 15 different rules. The question is that you end up with all these various branches, not necessarily the ones that are going to lead you to an answer. And that tends to be the problem with all this forward chaining, because it's not necessarily directed towards the goal that you're trying to solve. It's just trying to find new facts based on the rules that you have lying around. If you have just one rule like this, trivial in this case. Yep.
So it's pretty much the same as bottom-up parsing.
I guess no way you could look at it like that. Wow, these links you guys make are pretty incredible. Yeah, in a way it is. Yep. Oh. Nobody's ever said that before to me. But yeah, it is. It is this kind of idea. So you're going there from the bottom and you're just pushing. And you just keep deriving. And the problem is with this forward chaining is that it can derive a lot of unnecessary things because they may not be necessarily going to be used for your goal. This is a very simple problem. And you end up having what's known as this combinatorial explosion. And it's one of these problems that people face. So forward chaining and backward chaining that we're looking at are actually from the early days of AI, right? Some of the first things people thought they should be able to do. And one of the things they tried to do in 1959 was this kind of thing. They said, okay, we have a computer. They tried to do some geometry, and they tried to do forward chaining and backward chaining, but very quickly, you know, they could do some simple proofs in geometry, right? You encode it in logic. But anything that's even at the level of secondary school or high school or whatever, right, at that kind of level, the problems, the programs that they were writing at the time on punch cards or whatnot, right? But they still couldn't solve them because they completely got lost and ran out of memory, whatever little memory they had at the time, for instance, right? So if you're happy with this, let's look at the algorithm itself. So this is the algorithm here, right? So going to be first order logic forward chaining. So what we're asking is that if this is my KV and I have some sentence alpha I want to show follows from it, I want to return a substitution. Hey, why is that? That's all right. I want to return a substitution if the KB entails it, right? So KB is the knowledge base, a set of first order definite clause. So definite clause means you only have one positive atom in any clause, right? So you only have one literal on the right hand side of the implication, right? Alpha is the query, right, we're trying to make. So West is West a criminal. And local variables, we're going to have something new, remember? So it's the new sentences inferred on each iteration. So remember, so if you look at the algorithm here, that's first iteration, or zero, one iteration, two iteration, we find it in this case. So each time you keep the new facts that you derive. Okay, so, how do you start? Well, you start until you have nothing that you derive. So basically you keep running, so this rule runs exhaustively, right? So it's just keep doing it until you have nothing else that you can find that's new. That's what this is saying, until new is empty, so you start with nothing anyway. So for each rule in the knowledge base, so your knowledge base is going to have a number of rules, first thing you do, you make sure that your whatever rule you're taking, it's going to have fresh variables in there because you want to avoid problems if you have like X in one rule and the other rule also contains X. You don't want things to fail because of the occurs check because they're implicitly universally quantified, so they can be different names, right? So this is just a check. That's just to make sure that the rule here that you're going to use, given that you're going to be calling your unification algorithm in there, are going to have fresh variables, right? So it doesn't occur something. So standardize our variables apart means make sure, you know, all the variables that you have there so are fresh, right? So that you don't run into the occurs check problem, for instance. So that's one rule there. So you start doing like this, you're going to go through this loop. Well, for each theta, right, find a substitution such that, right? So this is the pattern matching bit. So if you find a substitution theta, right, such that P1 and dot, 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 Pn, so these are the assumption of the rule there that you have, is equal to P1 prime to Pn prime for some P1 prime to Pn prime in the knowledge base. So these are the facts you found. So in this case, it would be, these are the facts, these are the prime P1 primes, etc. Right, there are four of them in this case, and match them and see if you can match them to some rule, right, or one at a time, you just see, right? So for each of the substitution, if you can do that, right? If you've been able to do this, this means you've discharged all the assumption for that particular rule, right? So what is the substitution that you found? Apply it to the goal that you have there, to the conclusion of the rule. So just to take a simple example again. So for instance, this one, missile M1, so that's this one is just modus ponens. It just happens to boil down to modus ponens. So here's a generalized modus ponens rule here. So you have M1 and this one. So these are the two P1 prime and P2 prime, right? These happen to match, and the binding that you get, and you match it against this one, is that X is going to be M1, and that's it, just X is M1. So then you propagate this to the conclusion there, which was cells, you replace X with M1, right? So this is what this bit does there. Of course, then what do? You try to check whether I've actually solved my goal. If Q prime does not unify with some sentences, okay, before that, so you check whether it's something you found already, right? So this bit is the pattern matching bit, so you need to go in for your thing, for your database to find things that are going to match. If Q prime does not unify with some sentence already in the KB, meaning it's not something you've already found before, you don't want to do that, right? If you've already found it, you don't want to do anything, you just want to throw it out. Or something that's already is in you, that you, because it may be that you derive the same thing twice at the same level for some reason, right? Then you add Q prime to new, right? But the problem is, right, so you're just saying add whatever I've derived that's new to the, whatever I've derived that I've not seen before, add it to new. So this means you could derive things that are actually irrelevant, because there's nothing telling you this is something that's leading towards the goal that I'm trying to solve. Right? So that's the bit I was saying. It can go down a branch and keep going and derive things. And this can happen very often with rules such as which are transitive. Because you apply it and you keep applying, and you just nothing happens. Right? So let's assume. So we found this Q prime, it's something we haven't seen before. We check now whether Q prime actually can be unified with the goal we're trying to prove, the alpha. This is the bit. Right? So we try to say, by the way, this new fact that I found, is it the actual goal I was trying to prove? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Right? So if it is, right, so if I do manage to unify the two, and it's not a failure, right, if it didn't fail, then you can return the bindings that you wanted to return. So you wanted to return a set of substitutions, right, for your variables, such that your goal is true. Otherwise, what you do, so you keep going, you add new to the KB, so because you need to, so if you keep going and unify this, you add new to the KB. Yeah, that's true. So otherwise, what you do, it's no longer new because you're going to move to the next iteration in your algorithm. So you need to. So this is what this is saying. It's saying, I've done this, these were new, but at the next stage, these are not the, you know, I've done this, so now I need to move. So if I hadn't solved the goal, this would be the new set of new that would I derive at this stage. That's what this is doing. It just happens in this one, it's only two steps. Okay? If you keep going and you can't find anything, you return false. If you did everything you could by the forward chaining and you never was able to prove the goal, you return false in this case. Okay? Any questions? It's really not that difficult. The algorithm is just capturing exactly what we did in the graph, but it's just, of course, it has more details there. And the thing that you need to note, what can you tell me about this stage there? Yep?
Just clarify, after every iteration, you
add new to the model. No, it's for after, yeah, it's after each iteration of for each rule. Actually, that's not, yeah, you add it to the KB. Oh, no, but it's still there. It still remains in, you don't reinitialize new to, oh, yeah, you do. You move back, you move there for each rule, right? You add new to the KB. That new for the KB is outside of this one, right? So this is, oh, yeah, so it's after applying all the possible rules at one particular time. So this new is outside of this, right? So you do this and you keep going, right? Then you add new because you're going to try and do until new is empty. Yeah, that's right. Because then you start going again. Your new is reinitialized to empty. So this is what it's doing there, right? There. At this stage, you do all of this. So there's more than one rule applied at that level. One rule there, another rule there, another rule, right? So this is your new. Now you jump out of this. You make new. You add these things to the KB because they become new facts. And you reinitialize your new. It's not that. It should be easier to see where this, what's the scope of each one of these, unfortunately, because that's why I got stumped a little bit. So this is the scope of the for all there, right? When you jump out of this, you add new to the KB, and then you reinitialize new to empty to do the next level. Yeah, so sorry about that. It's the Russell and Novig. Yeah, so this is there. Yeah, are you happy? Okay, thanks. And it's slightly easier to see here for me. Okay. Hey, are you all happy with this? Right, so you do all the things, once you've derived all the facts at a particular level, applying all the rules, these become new facts that you just add to your knowledge base, and you reinitialize new to empty because you're moving to the next stage, right? Okay? So that's forward chaining for you. And what are some of its properties? Well, it's sound and complete for first order definite clauses. Sound meaning, again, the usual question, what does sound mean?
Shows on the right answers.
Hey?
Shows on the right answers.
What does that mean? More formally. How do you reason? Yeah. No, but remember, this is an algorithm. It's only going to derive facts that are? Don't say true. That are entailed. Use entailment, right? It's only going to derive facts that are things that are entailed by the knowledge base to start with. So it basically soundness links the derivation, the algorithm, to the semantic. So it's a single turnstile. That's what this algorithm does, links it to the double turnstile. So it's, yeah, so it's the right, it only gives true things that are true, but more formally, the only things that are originally entailed by the knowledge base. So be careful. And complete means using entailment. Will be found, exactly. Yeah, so if it is entailed, it will be derived by the algorithm. So that's pretty good, right? For first order definite, so that's why you can return false or a substitution. It's actually a decision procedure for these. For definite clauses, exactly one positive literal forward chaining is actually quite strong. It's a decision procedure for these restricted type of clauses, right? And so, and if you have what's known as data log clauses, so you don't have to worry. So that's just first order definite clauses with no functions. So we know no functions things are good generally. And forward chaining is actually now you have something even stronger. So you can say it's going to terminate in a finite number of iterations. Could be a lot of them, but it will terminate eventually. So you can let it go. You don't have to worry that it will never finish, right? It will terminate. But, of course, in general, if alpha is not entailed, it may not terminate. So this is about entailment. If something is entailed, it's fine. If it's not, because otherwise, you know, it's too much, right? This is unavoidable because entailment with definite clauses is still semi-decidable, right? This is the usual problem we had before. We already showed that, you know, if you reduce something to proportional logic, right, you may not be able to, you may keep going forever and never be able to show that if it's not entailed, you would go on forever. So this doesn't, there's no way this can be better because these are actually fundamental results in logic, right? So it is still, if you have something that is not entailed, you may keep going forever. But you may not find it because it just keeps applying. Right, so in general, basically. May not terminate in general if alpha is not entailed. Entailment with definite clauses is semi-decidable, same as before. Okay. So how efficient is it? So incremental forward chaining. So the way we looked at it, forward chaining is actually very general, right? Apply whatever applies. So there are ways of making this a bit better. So incremental forward chaining is one way. So what it tries to do is say, okay, no need to match a rule. So here's I have a huge database of rules. On some iteration k, if a premise wasn't added on iteration k minus 1, right? He's saying, you know, if I didn't add I didn't discover a fact that's going to match, that's going to be something that was discovered. So if I didn't discover a fact that's going to basically apply to this particular rule, there's no point trying to apply that rule because I'm not going to be able to make full progress. So you just say, okay, whatever I do on step 1, right, whatever I derive at a particular, whatever rule I decide to apply at a particular step, I must have something that satisfies its assumptions at the previous step. I don't try to do something that maybe I'll start applying it and find out I can apply, you know, I can satisfy three of its premises and one of its premises is not, or something that's all. So what it does, it prevents you from applying rules that are, you know, it sort of gives a kind of life, it gives like a notion of time to things, right? So things that are fresh. If I derive something new, I try to use it next if I can, right? Or I try to use a rule that's going to be something that's been derived. So you match each rule whose premise contains a newly added positive literal. So that's a kind of heuristic. It's sort of saying, let me try and explore things that I've just discovered now, as opposed to going back and using something that was there already from before. And it's just one way of doing things. And of course, yeah, I had this, I was going to talk about this. So the problem is that matching itself there, even though it's just one line here, this can be very expensive, right? Because your terms could be quite deep, and you have to go and look for them as well, right? And you have to match them to the assumptions of your rule, right? So matching itself can be expensive. And there are ways of doing things that can be, you know, we're not going to go into, but if you have, you know, quite sophisticated database indexing kind of methods, you can actually do things in constant time for known facts, right? So you would match this immediately with that. So as opposed to making, you know, there are ways of making this more interesting. So there's a whole area of deductive databases, which is like, you know, theory of databases based on deductive logic, so first order logic and all this, where forward chaining is what they use. And it's quite, I don't know if we do any advanced topics in deductive databases here. But there is a whole area of research known as deductive databases, and forward chaining is actually used a lot in there. Okay, I mean, I'm just mentioning this in passing. Okay, so, right, so the thing I want to mention is this bit, right, again, in a bit more detail, right, so pattern matching. So for each theta, we match whatever the assumption of the rule, right, so these are the hypotheses of a particular rule we're looking at right now. We're trying to match it against a number of facts that are in our knowledge base, right, and find a substitution. The problem is finding all the possible unifiers can be very expensive. So what would be nice would be to have some form of heuristic to help us to do this, and I can illustrate this by an example, right? Let's assume this is the rule we're looking at, right? X is a missile, Nunu owns X, and West sells X to Nunu, right? So one way of looking at this, which sort of hopefully illustrates what I'm trying to say, is that you could try to find each of the objects owned by Nunu in constant time, right? Let's assume we can do that very quickly, and then check if it is a missile, right? So we can check, you know, each object that somebody owns, whether it's actually something which is a weapon or a missile. Right? But what if Nunu owns loads of objects, which is likely to be the case, and just one or two missiles, right? Right? So, you know, what we want to do is to actually find a way of doing this which is the other way around, or something which is better. And this is what's known as conjunct ordering. So it's better cost-wise to find all the missiles that Nunu may own, right? We try and find, you know, because there are going to be fewer of these that match in the database, in the knowledge base. Right? So find all the missiles first and then check whether they are owned by Nunu. Right? Well, you know, because Nunu, you know, you have the whole inventory of everything that person owns. It's a bit like saying, you know, it's like blindly looking for something and decide, oh, is this a missile? But really what you want to look, this looks more like a missile and narrow the search first, right? And this is known as conjunct ordering, and it's sort of a kind of a semantic way of looking at it. So you know something about the knowledge base, you know something about the problem, and you say, okay, let's try to do this in, you know, even though it's written in this, and I might try to match this in the algorithm, it says just says try and match, right? You could make this finer grain and say, let's match this. If I found, let's match this first and then check whether somebody Nunu actually owns it, right? As opposed to saying, let's try to match both of these at the same time or do that first and then this one. So conjunct ordering is quite nice. So optimal ordering is NP-hard, which shouldn't come as a surprise, right? So it's very difficult to do, right? So if you could, things would be so much easier all the time. Right, so finding the optimal ordering is very difficult because it depends on the problem anyway. So there are heuristics available, and there's a link to MRV from CSP. Right, so if you view each of these as constraints on your conjunct, right, if each conjunct is viewed as constraints on its variables, there you can use this minimum remaining value heuristic to try and order, right? Because this one is going to have fewer, right? You're going to be fewer values of x generally. So you try to solve that one first. Right, this is where the MRV comes in there. I'm trying to remember. I think I asked this as an exam question once, just like, you know, what sort of thing. And I think one or two people got it. But it's interesting because suddenly you're taking something from CSP and bringing it in there. And if you look at this, really this one is more constrained than that one in general. At least you would think so, right? It's potentially the case. So you might as well try to satisfy this one first and then see what effect that has on the other constraints. Happy? No questions? All right. So bear this in mind. So this conjunct ordering is a heuristic. Obviously, it's just a heuristic, right? Maybe Nunu is just weird. He has like 200,000 missiles. And that's it. And he owns only missiles. So it doesn't matter then, right? So maybe it doesn't make... Or he owns like all these missiles and then a bottle of beer. And that's it. Doesn't make much of a difference. Okay? Right, so, and just to link it a little bit more to CSP, right, so actually it's also possible to look at any kind of, remember this problem, right, which is the map coloring of Australia, we can actually state it as one of these definite clauses, right, so we could say that all of these, you write down explicitly that all the colors are different for neighboring provinces or states or regions, and you want to come up with something that says it's colorable, right, and you have all these kind of constraints there. So that's, I mean, I'm not going to go any further than that. I'm just saying that every finite domain CSP can be expressed as a single definite clause plus ground facts. So it just goes to show that there is a way of going from one to the other, right? And then colorable, in this case, would just be inferred if and only if the CSP has a solution, right? But of course, CSPs, as we know, include FreeSat as a special case. So this means, right, it's not like you're not going to get any free lunch doing it like this either, right? Because trying to solve this is going to be as difficult because of the matching is NP-hard. So really, it just shows, here's another way of encoding a problem that you may have as a CSP problem. Just happens to be another way of doing it, but it doesn't mean that it's easy in any particular particularly easy. It doesn't mean that it becomes easier, really. It's just a question of representation, right? So that's just like to give you an example of the encoding of the map coloring problem. But matching is NP-hard, so that's the thing. So if it wasn't, it'd be easy to do, right? So it's having to solve all of this. You have to do all these matchings there and trying to figure out all the possibilities, which one's going to make sure you discharge all of it in a way that all of this can be consistent. It's the same problem, okay? Right, backward chaining now. So we looked at forward chaining, we can look at backward chaining. Let's do it the other way around as well for that one. So we want to show that West is a criminal. So backward chaining is interesting. So forward chaining actually corresponds in a lot of ways to the mathematical way we do things very often. If you're doing mathematics, it's like from this and this, I have this. And from that thing I've just derived, I know this and I have this. You can keep going forward. Backward chaining is a more kind of computer science, kind of software engineering kind of way of doing things where you try and say, here's my problem, I want to solve it. Can I break it down into sub-problems? So that's why it works in this way. So it's a bit less intuitive in a way. So what it's going to do is say, okay, how do I prove that West is a criminal? So now you start with the goal. Remember, the other one, you started with the facts and tried to move towards the goal, hopefully. This one says, I know what the goal is. Let me try and work backwards now to match against facts that I may have. So that's the difference, right? So I say, oh, I want to prove that West is a criminal. Well, what does it mean to say that West is a criminal? So if West is a criminal, West is a criminal if all of these have to be, all of these are true, right? I want to prove this for this. So this is the idea. So now it works backwards. It says, okay, let's match this against some conclusion and see what else I have to show that's true. Well, if West is a criminal, I have to show, okay, if I make X West, so I haven't done that yet, so I'm going to match backwards. So it's slightly, yes, so. What do I need to do? So I do this, I'm going to break this, I'm going to unify this with this, but I'm going also to propagate the binding that I find for X, right? So I haven't done that yet. So to prove that West is a criminal, what I need to show really is that West is American, Y is a weapon. I don't know what Y is yet, right? There is something that, you know, that's Y there, it's a variable. That X sells Y to Z, but X I know is this, and Z is hostile, right? So I'm going to be propagating the binding. So what do I do? Well, can I prove that West is an American? Yeah, that's trivial because I have this in my knowledge base, right? So I'm looking at it branch by branch. So the way it works, I'm not propagated. So I just know by doing this that X is West. When I move to this to try and solve this, I say, right, so let me just redo this to show why it's like this. So West, X is West by matching against this, right? Now I need to solve this one. So this X, I'm going to look at this branch first. X is West because I know this already from my binding. Well, it's easy, this one, because I have it as a fact. So I'm done with that one. Let's move to the next one now, okay? Well, I want to show that Y is a weapon. Well, what does it mean? If Y is a weapon, I work backwards, it's a missile, right? I'm going to show that maybe, if it's a weapon, maybe it's a missile I'm going to try and solve, right? Okay, so I'm there, right? So Y doesn't have any binding because the only thing that I found for X was that X is West. Well, I can do this one. I can solve this one by making Y M1 because it's a fact in my knowledge base. So my list of bindings is growing over there, right? List of substitution that I'm hoping I'm going to return at the end, right? So I make Y M1. So these two goals are done, right? Now what about this? What happens to this one? I want to be able to solve that sub-goal now, right? Well, I know that X is West, and I know that Y is M1. I don't know what Z is, right? So I'm going to try and do this, okay? How do I do this? I apply this one backwards. Well, I can propagate the binding. So basically I'm saying it's missile M1, right? And also it owns, so what do you have here? So West, so it's going to be owns Nunu M1, right? Okay, but the fact that I have this, if I'm going to match this, it means that Z here has to be Nunu, right? Because that's what this match against. If I match it against this, immediately I get, actually, so I should do this differently. I match this against this, and immediately I get the binding for Z is Nunu, right? So these are the two sub-goals now that I have for this one. Right, and this is still open as a sub-goal. Well, but I can solve this one easily because that's a fact in my knowledge base. This one is also a fact in my knowledge base. And how do I prove this one? Well, I work backbone for this one. Hostile, Nunu, if I have this, if no enemy of America, so Nunu is an enemy of America, enemy Nunu America. But that's also given to me there. Right, so it just basically breaks it down into sub-problems until you can match against. So here you've gone from the goal, and eventually you match against the facts that you have in your knowledge base, basically. Right? Yeah? So that's the difference. So you start from the goal, you break into sub-goals, and you break into sub-problems. And so how does the algorithm work? There you go. So this is the backward chaining. So we have a KB, we have some query, right? And returns what's known as a generator of substitutions in this case, just slightly different, right? So we're going to call the KB with some query and some empty substitution to start with. So that's just some terminology from Russell and Norvig. A generator is just going to be a function that returns multiple times, each time giving one possible result, right? So because you may want to find one, if there's more than one substitution, more than one way of satisfying that goal, right? So what do you do to start with? Okay, so this is it, we're calling it. So for each rule like this, of this form, left-hand side, arrow, right-hand side, you fetch the rules in the KB that match that might match the goal. So you try and find what are the potential candidates' rules that might match the goal, right? So in this case, if you see the example, there's only one, it's this one, right? And you found the potential candidates. What you do again here as well is to make sure that you have fresh variables in there to prevent things from happening that you don't want, like unification error occurs check problems and all this. Because remember, you assume that all the variables in the rule are universally quantified. You just want to make sure that they are fresh universal variables, right? So you standardize apart. Now what do you do, right? For each theta in the, you're going to call this bit, you're going to call this, right? You're going to try and find, okay, let me try and find how I can unify the goal with the right-hand side of the rule, right, with some theta, right, such that also, yeah, it's a bit difficult, right, so actually to look at this, right. So you're going to do you're going to call this auxiliary algorithm, this auxiliary function here, where you're going to say, okay, try and solve it for this right-hand side, but also pass the whatever's on the left as the other goals that I need to solve. This is what this is trying to do, right? It's going to say, okay, I've unified the goal against the conclusion of the rule, right? Now, try and solve all of the left-hand side of what was that rule. So it's this one. It's this. So this is what you've matched, right? But then you end up with all these things that you need to solve, but you need to apply the substitution. You need to use the substitution that you've found with them. So this is this bit. It says, okay, this is the left-hand side. These are the left-hand side of the rule. I want to solve it. I want to solve all of them, so it's an end. Yeah. So this one is an OR, meaning there may be more than one possibility of matching the goal against a particular rule. That's why it's an OR there. But this one's an end now says, if you've picked a particular rule that matches, solve all the sub-goals that arise now from its left-hand side, right? Okay? For each one of these. And if you can do this, you return, each time you can solve it, you return the substitution as a particular candidate substitution, something that solved the goal, right? Okay? So how does this one work? Okay, so this is my KB there. These are the goals I want to solve. So it's assumed there may be more than one goal, right? If theta is failure, because I couldn't do something with it, so I return immediately. Else, if the length of goals, so I have no goals to solve, or so I'm done, then you return the theta, so you're done, right? So this is like the last one. Else, break the goals into the first sub-goal and the rest of the sub-goals, right? Now what you're going to do for each of these sub-goals that you have there, right, for the first one to start with, try and solve it using this again. So it's mutually recursive, right? So this is my new goal now, try to solve this. So this is my example here. In this case, I've done this. This is an end there, right? This is what shows it's an end choice. I need to solve all of these, right? This is an end bit. Now it says, okay, for this one, try and see how you can solve this one, right? So this is what this bit does. Let's see, try to solve it. There might be more than one way of it to match whatever you have in the knowledge base, whatever goal, whatever rule there may be in the knowledge base. But in this case, it's trivial because it just happens to match this immediately. There's only one fact that can match, so it's trivial. And once you've done this for that one, keep going, right? Do it for the rest of the goals. So this is saying, once you've solved this one, like here, now you need to do this one, that one, and that one in turn. Okay? So what makes this a bit, it's really just capturing the tree that we saw before. What makes it look complicated is the fact that it's mutually recursive, right? So this one calls this one, but this one calls that one back. So what happens is that basically this is the goal, and each time each of these become a new sub-goal, so you need to call the algorithm with the O again. So that's why you jump back to this one each time, to this bit, right? And then so I'll show you. So this is this example there. So you jump to this one. This is a sub-goal you need to prove, right? But it's going to have two new sub-goals, right? So these are n sub-goals. So when you apply this, you need to solve both of these. So that's why you go back to the n. Yeah? Are you happy with this? Thank you so much. But, It looks a bit complicated. So just have a look at it. If anything's not clear, just let me know. Right? So it's mutually recursive algorithm because you solve a goal, it gives you sub-goals, and for each one, you again have to recursively call the n choices to try and solve all of its all of the assumptions of a particular rule. Okay? So that's backward chaining for you. So what do we have? Well, what sort of properties? So depth-first recursive proof search, right? So usually that's how you use it. So the space is going to be linear in the size of the proof, right? And it can be incomplete due to infinite loops. So it is possible, especially with things like I said again, with transitivity rules, you say, okay, x is less than y, but prove that x is less than some z, and z is less than y, for instance. You end up breaking it. Nothing prevents you from applying transitivity over and over and over, right? So I don't know if you follow what I'm saying. So one problematic rule is something like this one. If you have this. So if I apply this backwards to anything, a is less than b, then I end up like x is less than a, and so I can work backwards, a is less than y, and y is less than b. But I can keep going. I can apply this rule and keep going, right? So I can keep doing this and never solve it. So this is a less than y. Then I can do another step where it's going to be a less than or equal to y prime, and y prime less than or equal to y. And I keep going like this, introducing new variables, and it never stops. So that can be problematic with anything that's transitive, especially. You look puzzled. Are you happy with this? Yeah. OK, good. I know. And so that can be a problem. So one partial fix is for checking whether the current goal against every goal on the stack is something you've seen already. So that's something that you can try and do. Is it something that I've seen already if it's on the stack? Well, there's no point trying to solve this. I have something that I have. If I solve it now, I'll solve everything. So there's no point carrying on. I can prune. And you can have repeated sub-goals. It has no idea, usually, if you've solved it once, the two sub-goals, they happen to be the same. You solve it once, you need to solve the other one. Even though you've solved it once, you would hope that you could use it for the same, but you usually can't. They're just independent, viewed as independent. But what you could do is to fix using caching of the previous results, for instance. Some kind of, but it entails extra space. But it's widely used in logic programming, so Prolog and all these kind of things. All right. Any questions? No? Okay. So forward chaining, from the facts you go forward, you derive new facts. Backward chaining, from the problem that you're trying to solve, you get new sub goals that you break it down into new sub goals. That's the general idea. And now, given that you've seen resolution and all this, we can go very quickly just to revise this. Right, so we've seen two particular algorithms for doing deduction, right? For basically doing for inference, and resolution is just yet another one, right? So the idea is that you're going to have clauses, right? So we've seen about clauses already. So if you have something of the form C or P, and you have D or not P, right? Just look at binary resolution, meaning you only have two particular literals there. Then you can derive C or D. You remember this? Yeah, vaguely. So why is this sound? I can give a quick argument. C or P is basically if and only if not C implies P, and D or not P if and only if P implies D. So I can use the transitivity of implication to say, therefore, not C implies D, which is equivalent to C or D, which is the conclusion. That's just a quick way of saying, you know, of showing why this rule is actually sound in terms of reducing it to the property of, transitivity property of implication, right? If both C and D are empty, right? For instance, if C and D are not there, you only have P and not P, then you get the empty clause immediately, right? Empty meaning, yeah, if you have nothing there, right? Then resolution deduces the empty clause, false. And usually this is what you're going to be looking for, right? So this is ground. How does it extend to the non-ground version? Well, it's very similar, except now you're going to have a notion of some substitution that's going to make P and not P prime. Let's assume these contain variables. They're going to just find a substitution that's going to be the most general unifier of P and P prime in this case. And once you've found a substitution that makes these two identical, we just apply it to the rest of the clause that you put together, C or D. Right? So the two clauses, of course, are usually, so that's one thing that's important. So implicitly, even for these kind of clauses, everything is assumed to be universally quantified. So what you do usually is that the clauses are assumed to be standardized apart so that they do not share any variables. Because otherwise, if you don't do this, if you don't standardize the clauses apart, things can go wrong because of unification, right? And how do we show this is sound? Is that we can apply theta to the premises and appeal to ground binary resolution. So if we apply theta to everything, basically we can reduce this to the same as being as ground resolution. Yeah? So that shouldn't be a problem either. So it boils down to the soundness of, if you can show that the ground resolution is sound, you can reduce this to ground resolution, and you've got soundness implicit as well for that one. Okay. So you did do first order resolution, right? Yeah, okay. you all look at me, it's like, why is he talking about them? You do. So here's an example here. If somebody's rich, then they so either somebody's not rich or they're unhappy. Ken is rich. Yeah, Ken is unhappy. So this is it. So that's one way of doing it. So we just unify this with this. X becomes Ken, unhappy Ken. Poor Ken. Right? So I mean, so we've gone back for the two rules. There's an additional rule that we can have, which is known as factoring. And usually we have this. We need this when we're working with binary resolution. What is factoring? Factoring is a way of basically collapsing particular literals that you have in a clause. So if you have something like this, COP1 or dot, 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 OPM, right? What you can do, if you can find a unifier of some kind, a Bose general unifier of all the various PIs, and you can make all of them identical, then this is what follows. So if you can find a way of substituting through P1 to PM so that they're all the same, right, then you can replace this with COP1 with the theta applied to it, right? Or COP2 with the theta applied to it. It doesn't matter because they've all been made to be identical. So that's known as the factoring rule. And the question is, why am I introducing this? Well, you'll see in a second. So how is it sound? It's sound by universal instantiation. You've seen this. And deletion of duplicates, right? So if you do universal instantiation and then you just find all the ones that are identical, you can collapse all the ones that are identical. So, and what do we want to say? Okay, so there's the more general version of resolution. So did you do full resolution as well? Okay, so what does full resolution do? Well, it's about saying, okay, if I have a clause, so it's a general version of resolution, right? Binary resolution is just a special case of this. Where I have COP1 dot 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 OPM, then I have another clause which is DOP'1, which is negated there, or dot 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 to PN. So one thing that's slightly different in your slides, if you've got this, you'll see that there's a little, well, it's not a typo, but it doesn't have these I's. So these don't have to be the same numbers, right? It could be different, you know, you could have like one clause, one particular literal there, and 10 of them. If you're able to find a most general unifier that's going to make all of these the same as all of these, even though they're opposite in sign, so you can find a most general unifier for all the PIs and all the PJs there, or the P prime J's, right? Then you can deduce this. So you can basically, it's like canceling. So the idea is that you're trying to find a substitution that's going to enable you to cancel the equal but opposite atoms, right? So it's like saying, you know, it's like crossing this out. Can I find anything that's positive here? Can I find its negation there somehow, right? That's all you're doing. So you end up collapsing the clause into C or D with the substitution applied to it, right? And how do we show that this is actually sound? Well, because we can use the notion of factoring in binary resolution. Because once we got the idea of finding the substitution that makes all of these identical, factoring, if these are all identical, that just collapses. And these are all identical, that just collapses, and then just binary resolution, right, as before. Right? So if we collapse all of these by factoring, then we can just use binary resolution. And the idea now is, once we've got the resolution, is that what we're going to do is to do these kind of refutation proofs. If I want to show that the KB entails some sentence alpha, I'm going to say, okay, let's convert the KB and the negation of alpha. So that's important, right? We need to negate something, so we negate the goal, usually, right? Then we're going to convert this to CNF, which we've seen before, and then we're going to try to see whether we can derive the empty clause. So we're trying to show that the negation of the goal with the knowledge base is, if I put these together, I'm going to get something which is inconsistent, right? And if it is inconsistent, it means that it's positive, means that alpha actually was entailed originally. So that's just the idea of refutation, right? And this is going to be complete for first order logic if full resolution or binary resolution plus factoring is used. So if something is entailed, it will be able to give you a proof. If it's not entailed, semi-decidable. You're left on your own with your algorithm obviously going on forever, and you're getting older. So quickly, so conversion to CNF. Do you remember this? You do implication, you do implication if and only if first, right? Then what do? Then you move not in, right? We've done that before, right? So let's assume there's an example here. I'm not going to go through it in detail. Just to show what I want to point out is this is the scope of the Y there. You can still have Y again there, right? They're not the same Y. So the red one, this is this one, and this one is just a different. But the scope of the X goes all the way to there, right? And these are things people usually find difficult. Or at least they, when you're doing this loads of sentences one after the other, say in the exam or whatever, in a coursework, suddenly somehow you drop the quantifier or you forget to put a bracket and your X, your Y there becomes the same as this Y and things go really wrong, right? So you remove all implications or if and only ifs, right? So they're on implication and you get this. And then you move the negation inwards, right? So you can move all of them there, through there, through there, through there. And the interesting thing is this. Once you've done all the moving of all the, of negation all the way in, now, because you're going, once you convert things to clauses, right? Remember, so resolution assumes, for instance, that all the variables are